So this is an adaptation of one of the talks that Simon's given. Been brought up to date with some new developments, but I've also put some of the things which I know more about. So I don't profess to be an expert in all of the areas, but it's intended to give an overview of parallel programming languages because they're kind of back in fashion. There's lots of them, and it's kind of an interesting landscape. A quick intro to our group at Bristol. Yeah, we're the microelectronics research group. And so this is the team. So Simon, who was going to do the talk tonight, is the head of the group. And there's seven staff in total, two professors and then four other lecturers. David May, who some of you might know, and Diraj Padran. So David does things with scalable real-time processor architectures and Diraj is fault tolerance. There's also six research assistants, 16 PhD students. And the group expertise can be summarised under the umbrella of energy-aware computing, of which there's been a number of workshops held at Bristol recently, or ECO for short. And there's a whole bunch of areas which we're actively researching in, so many-core computer architectures. And there's strong relation to sort of industry in and around Bristol, so in particular INMOS, which you know now does not exist, but sort of sowed the seed of a lot of this in Bristol. XMOS, which is you might have heard of, is a recent spin-out from the university, a venture from David introducing new processor architecture. And also ClearSpeed, Pixel Fusion, of which Simon was involved with. They were those companies to develop these general-purpose GPU-type architectures. So there's also work on algorithms for heterogeneous systems, network-on-chip, electrical and optical, reconfigurable FPGA-type architectures, and design and verification, and fault tolerance. So it's quite a sort of a spectrum. So yeah, an overview of the talk. So the first section just to look what's going on with parallelism, just to make the point that it's really mainstream and it's emerging in all areas of computing, you know, in the whole spectrum. And then to look at two recent and kind of popular languages at either end of this spectrum. So one of them is Chapel and the other is OpenCL. You may not have heard of these. Yeah, and so just to kind of review those. And then to look at how things are moving forward. And again, just taking an example, so a recent announcement by AMD, which is their heterogeneous system architecture. And then just to finish on a note about some of the research that we've been doing into scalable general purpose systems. So didn't parallel computing used to be a niche? Yes, I think it did. There was a huge amount of excitement, I think, in the 70s and 80s about this all, but unfortunately it never really took off in a big way, and certainly in mainstream kind of commodity systems the kind of architectural focus was on frequency scaling. But it has a long history in HPC, and this is a picture of the N-cube machine, which was installed in Sandia National Labs in 1989. So in HPC they've always had to employ parallelism to be able to have the kind of performance that they need for these computationally intensive tasks. So this system had 1,024 processors and I think delivered 1.9 gigaflops performance. But now it's kind of everywhere and is in consumer commodity devices. This is the new PlayStation kind of handheld. And this has got a quad-core ARM and a quad-core Imagination GPU. So CPU and GPU. And it's necessary for the applications that are running on these things to exploit this parallelism in order to deliver the kind of performance that people come to expect of these devices. So as I mentioned to you, the speed at which we can run a sequential stream of instructions is basically topped out. So parallelism is the way forward, and in computer architecture, parallelism is the primary means of increasing system performance. This is the world's fastest supercomputer, according to the top 500 list. So it's in Japan, it's called the K-Computer, and it has over 700,000 Spark processor cores, and it delivers 10.5 petaflops, which is 10 quadrillion calculations a second. So it's a huge system. I think it's the peak performance is the same as the combined other top 10 systems. It's huge. But interestingly enough, it uses no GPUs or accelerators, so it's a homogeneous architecture, and 9.9 megawatts to get this thing running, which is equivalent to a $10 million electricity bill a year. we're also seeing this increasing use of GPUs at the high end, and even in these consumer devices, so in the PlayStation thing. In supercomputers, this is the second fastest supercomputer currently, and it's got 7,000 NVIDIA GPUs. But what's interesting about this is the contrast between these two architectures. Very different approaches, very different programming models, and so there's really little consensus really on how is the best way to build these machines. And so big computing is mainstream too. The provision of large-scale internet services, Google, Facebook, Amazon and things, require a huge amount of computing, so a huge number of servers. This is a picture of Google's new data center in Washington, with a couple of links there. And it's estimated that Google, well, in August 2011, that Google uses about 900,000 servers, so this could be near a million now to provide the service that they... So in all of this, we have parallelism in high-performance computing, in desktop computing, in embedded computing, across the spectrum. And with it, we've got a whole swathe of programming languages. So there's, been a kind of renaissance in it. And these are just to name a few of the kind of more recent developments. I guess a couple of them are older. I mean, MPI is kind of old, but most of these is a fairly new development. But what we have is kind of a fragmented landscape where these kind of languages are developed for a specific architecture. So we have the GPUs, GPU-type languages, or the multi-threaded, say, to run on CPU or GPU. And there's not really any portability between these. So, one program which you express in a GPU language may not run on a CPU or distributed architecture, for instance. And then there's also these PGAS languages, which I'm going to talk about more. So there are a huge number of languages, but just in this talk, just to give you a flavour of it, I was going to talk about two. The first being Chapel, which is a language in the high-performance computing space and a relatively new development, and certainly not kind of a production-quality language. So it's still being changed quite a lot. But it's under development by Cray, and it's funded by DARPA as part of a large program for high-productivity computing. The main goal of it is to improve programmer productivity. So the observation is that in high-performance computing, where the conventional model of programming is MPI, so the message passing interface, very low level, very difficult. It takes a very long time to develop software, and the systems which are developed in this way are difficult to maintain and hard to reason about. So it's looking to raise the level of abstraction and make programmers more productive. So people who are writing these programs to be able to write them more quickly, to be more expressive. And on top of that, it wants to match or beat current performance of other programming models, so in particular MPI, and support better portability. It's targeting multi-core desktops, cluster-based systems, obviously the Cray architecture, and there is GPU support in progress. So it's a partition globally resource language, or PGAS. And the interesting thing about these is the central abstraction is of a large array. So in the same way that we're used to in conventional programming languages, except that this array is partitioned across the system in some way. So there's some notion of different parts of the array belonging to different locations in the system. And this gives the programmer control of locality by allowing them to express the affinity of tasks and data to particular areas in the system. The only way that you get these large-scale parallel computations to scale is to increase locality as much as you can while obviously increasing parallelism.
Can I just ask a question?
Yeah, sure.
Now, I think perhaps what would be useful to separate would be what the hardware can do from the actual image that we're making of it in the language. We're making an abstraction. So in the hardware, I mean, are we saying that each processor can only address its own memory?
No.
Will this run on different kinds of hardware? I take it that in the software abstraction, each thread can typically address any bit of memory that's visible in scope.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, so there's still a global shared address space in this language, and you can access anything remotely in the system. But because you do it through this notion of what Chapel calls locales, it makes the program aware of when you are performing operations that incur latency across the machine.
But while there's a global address space in the language, it might not be to the processor.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. So, and this language does claim to be high level and kind of an abstract model of a parallel machine. And the way in which it actually works is that the language is compiled into a message passing C-type structure. And I guess the central question with this is certainly, can you implement the type of abstractions that this language provides efficiently? And I think the answer is no.
Can you just compare this on-disk space with Fortran co-arrays?
Okay, so Fortran co-arrays. I think that is a partition.
We had a talk on it, and I don't remember these, but I think the arrays are...
Did I put it?
You did mention it.
Co-array Fortran is a partition global address space language. Yeah, so it's It employs this same abstraction.
One bit of the array is owned by one process. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe this be clear. I'm going to talk about these examples. So, so this main abstraction, global array, and in Chapel, the arrays are kind of a more general concept. And these pictures here show what different type of arrays you can have. So, dense, strided, sparse, unstructured, associative. So they're basically kind of any data structure. So it's these are kind of different domains on an array. And an array can be distributed with a domain map. All right? And a domain map specifies a mapping from the indices in the domain to the locales in the system. And these red lines segmenting these different arrays show example domain maps. And the benefit of doing this is that you separate the mapping and distribution of data around the system from the computations that you're trying to perform.
So do those red boundaries actually define locality?
Yes. So, yeah, within one of these these squares, these data elements would be owned by a single locale. So you want to be able to express computations which work on these arrays. And the main type of parallelism, the key type of parallelism in Chapel is data parallelism. And this is provided through a zippered for all statement. And this, in this example here, you have three arrays, A, B, and C, and this for all iterates over these arrays, taking elements out according to some iteration function, depending on what type of domain the array has. But the loop body sees the ith element from each iteration and is computed in parallel. Yeah, and so the neat idea about this is that this statement works when these arrays are distributed, and even if the distribution of A can be different from B or C, so they could have completely different distributions. And you can also define iterators, so A, B, or C could be more complicated data structures, such as trees or graphs. So it is very neat.
So is this right? What we're doing is we're taking a tuple of arrays and we're looking at it as if it were an array of tuples. Is that right? And then we're taking the first A, B, C tuple.
Yes, 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 that's right.
So given that that's what we're doing, we're exchanging tuple and array, the thing would be a neater way of expressing it in language.
Right, yeah.
And maybe that's the right way.
I guess it depends, the kind of thing you're trying to do. I mean, certainly for this example where you're just summing, taking consecutive elements from each array. So here we've completely separated what we're trying to do from the data. But I guess the question is, if these arrays really do have distributions, domains which could be strided, unstructured, and then distributions over the system, how clever can the compiler be about generating code which can efficiently shuffle this stuff around?
What's the control of when you can actually reconfigure the data? Presumably you can reconfigure the data without changing the algorithm, without changing the program.
Yes, yeah.
So when can you do that? Presumably not during the execution of the program.
I wouldn't know. So the domain distributions are written in Chapel, and they would be... Yeah, it would be compiled, so it'd be static, yeah. So interestingly, the library implementations of domain distributions are also defined in Chapel, so any distribution that you would make should have similar performance, so there shouldn't be a huge... And there's this kind of... So at the top level of the abstraction in Chapel, you have data parallelism, and then below that you have task parallelism, where you can dispatch remote tasks, create sets of threads and things, and these domain distributions are implemented in this kind of lower level layer.
Can I just ask you about these trees and graphs? Is there some support for this?
Well, this is where you would define your own, or depending on what chapel provides you, you would use a chapel iterator to move through these things or to define your own. Having not actually played around with it myself, I couldn't tell you exactly.
Serially biased.
Yeah.
So
is iterative. Yeah. I mean, like I said, it's difficult to see how this, what is essentially kind of a scripting language type notation where you have very flexible kind of, but this is what they're trying to do.
So in your capital A, B, and C, are you kind of fundamentally defining areas of data parallelism at the top level, saying that capital A, B, and C are completely independent?
Mm-hmm.
And then for your task parallelism, that's the compiler's job below that somehow to further break down your data parallelism.
Yeah, I mean, you would have to express this loop such that there's no dependencies between successive iterations, and the compiler's job is to express this data parallelism in terms of task parallelism. Yeah. So to shuffle things around, move data to form the computation.
The idea is that you're going to express as a program some of the things that you think can be made parallel in some way, and then there's going to be a level where the compiler takes over from there and does more of these things.
I don't think it will introduce any more parallelism. I mean, what you're saying here is that each of these expressions can be executed in parallel.
Well, I was just wondering, so you say capital A, B, and C.
Yeah.
Is this going to run on three processors, or if that actual computation below...
No, so the amount of parallelism that exists in the computation is going to be dependent on how long these arrays are themselves. So the amount of work that is given to each processor depends on the decomposition of the data structure over the set of locales. So if there's four, then each processor will take a quarter of each array and then will perform quarter of the total amount of work.
Right, I was splitting it by capital A, B, and C. And in fact, it's not.
Yeah, sorry.
A could be partitioned in its own time.
So if you imagine that A, B, and C are all partitioned over the machine, you know, in some way. If A, B, and C aren't distributed, then this for loop will be executed as a kind of local thread, multi-threaded parallelism, rather than distributed parallelism with message passing. Yeah, I just included that because, you know, two lines, how do we do it in open MPI and open MP? Well, with a lot more work, this doesn't even consider, you know, exotic distributions of data and things. And this is how we, all supercomputing applications are written. Well, this or in Fortran, but in a kind of similar way. So it's low level. The experience has been that people like it, and that's how you get performance. So, and they've not given it up yet for these PGAS type languages. Okay, and so the other big thing in Chapel is that you can compose these notations for parallelism together. So one of the ways you can do this is with a cobegin statement, which causes all of the contained statements to be executed in parallel. And in this example, we've got two of these data parallel for all loops. So this will just execute them together. And then this composition works as kind of arbitrary nestings of data and task parallelism. So for instance, you could nest task parallelism within data parallelism. So here, for each element in this, so compute in parallel for each element in A, in this conditional statement, and we're saying, and this might be useful, it might be useful to do something like this, where F takes a long time to compute and G doesn't. So we would want to, at this begin statement, we can use this to asynchronously fork a thread to complete that computation, and we can get on with the next thing, which might be a G or, you know, to fork another F. So, I mean, when you look at this, and certainly if you're writing an application for a large supercomputer with hundreds of thousands of cores, then I'd want to know exactly how it was going to go about distributing the work and, you know, whether it would partition the machine in half, whether these computations would be overlaid. There's not much details about that in the literature. Begin means compute this statement asynchronously. So this begin will complete immediately, there'll be a new thread created, that work will be performed on that thread. But it means that the thread that's executing this is then able to carry on with something else. Sorry, say that again, Tay.
You use the begin key word only once in one of the if statements.
Yeah. Okay, so I took this out of one of the papers. The reason given was that if the computation of F takes a long time with respect to G, then the thread which is executing this work will be able to get on with other useful things. But I think the point is that, yeah, if we're computing all of these things independently in A, the semantics don't change. So what I think this is more a hint to the compiler. Issues with TRAPL, like I said, it's a HPC language. It's general purpose HPC, but yeah, I mean, it's not much good for programming embedded platforms, for instance. Yeah, this idea of representing a system as a set of locales supports only a single level of hierarchy. And you know, potentially there's better ways to represent systems. So to capture the memory hierarchy, to capture attached devices such as GPUs and other accelerators. This is something that they might add to it. There's no load balancing or dynamic resource management. So this is stuff that you would, as a programmer, have to implement in your software. And there's this question of, you know, is this the right level of abstraction? You know, how useful is it? And certainly with these data parallel loops, it almost becomes kind of domain specific. So it's very potentially useful for certain problems in computational science, but maybe that's the wrong focus of a general purpose language. So yeah, the second one to talk about is OpenCL. It's this open computing language. And so yeah, like I said, this lies at the other end of the spectrum. So this is concerned with programming heterogeneous systems. So I mentioned sort of homogeneous, heterogeneous. The development of modern systems has arrived to a point where it may include one or more CPUs, one or more GPUs, DSPs, and potentially other devices attached together. And the question is, how do you write software for these? And certainly, how do you do so in a portable way? OpenCL is a standard which kind of aims to do this. Let's the programmer write single portable program that uses all the resources in the platform. I mean, it's basically aimed at platforms with a CPU and one or more GPUs, I guess. So the model that it uses is this. So you have a single host device, which is attached to one or more compute devices, where each compute device contains a number of compute units, and each compute unit contains a number of processing elements. So yeah, the compute devices can themselves be GPUs or CPUs, but yeah, there's a single host. And this is the memory model. And it's kind of hierarchical. There's a single host memory at the top, well, which can access the compute device through a global and constant memory. And then a compute device will contain a number of work groups, which each contain local memory. And then the work groups will contain a number of work items, which each contain private memory. In the program model, all of the movement of data between these levels of the hierarchy has to be explicit. And doing so in an efficient way is very important to getting good performance out of these devices. So in particular, transferring data between the host memory and global memory, I think, is the biggest issue. And you have to worry a lot about doing big block transfers, or coalesced reads and writes, as they're called, between the two.
So would it be fair to say that the host memory is functionally equivalent to the global address space that you were talking about before, but you wouldn't actually, in your individual program segments, wouldn't access that because it would be highly inefficient?
So in this model, the individual program segments, which are these work items, are not able to access this. So what happens is that you will launch a kernel, which I'll explain in a second, onto a compute device. And anything that kernel needs will need to be copied into the global and constant memory. And then it will access that. But in order to make these things go fast, you want to limit as much as possible the amount of access into this memory. And you want to make sure that as much of the data fits as you can fits into these caches. And actually, I was speaking to a colleague today, and he was looking at performance figures for a bunch of benchmarks that he's been running on GPUs written in CUDA. and he's got really bad performance, and he thinks what's causing that is actually all of the register spills and causing the work items to be making a lot of read and writes from private memory. And the kernels that are running fast are the ones with only small amount of register spilling. So yeah, these devices are kind of quite temperamental, and you need to be very aware of how this memory hierarchy works, and you know, what sizes things are. You need to size your problem. And certainly, once your problem exceeds the size of this global memory, and you can't do these coalesced reads and writes, single big block transfers, your performance, you know, it takes a steep dive. Yeah, the big idea behind OpenCL. I mean, this is a kind of more an artifact of the way that GPUs work, I guess. But given a traditional loop, in order to get it to run on a CPU, we've reformulated in terms of a kernel. And this kernel is executed at each point in this iteration space. For each value of I, there'll be an invocation of this and a calculation of this. So the kind of task that GPUs used to perform, to process an image, you know, for 1,024 pixels square, there'd be, you know, over a million executions of this. Yeah, and there's various like restrictions on the type of arguments, and that you can share data between threads in a single work group, but you can't share things between work groups, and you can synchronize between threads in a work group, but you can't synchronize that work group. And it's all kind of artifacts of the way that these things are built. And this is essentially boilerplate code, but this is what you have to write every time on the host. The point being that it's still a very low-level API / programming language. Yeah, I mean, these are the different parts of it. Define the platforming key, define memory objects, create the program, set up the kernel, execute, read the results back. So it's setting up all of this memory, transferring things over between the kernels. Yeah, there's... Okay, so this isn't... There's not... Yeah, so this kernel would be written in a separate file. That's included in the computation. This is OpenCL, yeah.
And the other bits are written in something else, right? Or is that OpenCL as well?
This will be written in C using the OpenCL API, yeah. Yeah, so one recent development is a C++ version of the language, I think, or bindings, which really clean a lot of this up. I haven't got the slide on that in here, but yeah, they're moving to do that.
You think that with all this memory and pipeline and stuff, it'd be really important, and there'd be some new ways of writing pipelines to really do it. But I think
Well, I mean, essentially, that's the only way in which you can express parallelism in the program. Data parallelism, it's a special instance of task parallelism. Yes, and it doesn't allow you to express other structures. So I think that's probably, yeah, one of the shortcomings of this, along with these as well. So yeah, as I said, it's low level. It's essentially assembly language for these things. And interestingly, it doesn't compose. So when we're building a complex piece of software, we want to be able to express it in a number of subcomponents, you know, composed together. And the useful property of these subcomponents is that in a kind of a well-defined programming language is that you can swap any subcomponent out with another one which has the same external semantics. There's a couple of things in OpenCL which don't really allow you to do this in quite the right way. And so one of them is that you have this issue of disjoint memory address spaces. So you have the device global memory and the local memories. If a function takes an argument of a global variable and you try and call that argument with a variable that's declared in a local scope, declared as a local variable, then you basically won't be able to do that. But it kind of doesn't make much sense in the programming language. And there's also this issue with barriers. So as I said, in a work group with a bunch of threads, they can synchronize on barriers. And if a barrier is in a piece of control flow in one of the threads and the barrier's not executed, the whole thing will just hang. So you know, you have to be quite careful about the way that you use them, certainly if you're composing things in a modular way. So it also doesn't provide any resource management. Kernels are allocated statically at compile time, so there's no opportunity to create new kernels to distribute work over the GPU. Yeah, is there any questions?
So do you have to know your architecture of writing chips or something you're writing for up front?
I would say so, yeah. I mean, if you look at the kind of the literature in this area, so much of it is this algorithm for this GPU using this language. and it's taken a bunch of people to work it out. And this is the scaling, you know, problem size. And like I said, the you know, the guy that I spoke to today has all of these things, and it's, and then all of a sudden you get 100 times worse performance, and it's just, it's not quite clear why. And so you start thinking, well, you know, what could it be? And it turns out it's, you know, register spilling in the compiler, and that is. And so I think, yes, you do have a very detailed knowledge of this to get things working right. Yeah, and I think this is one of the reasons why it won't catch on. But the next thing I'm going to talk about, I think we'll try and address that.
But with this, presumably, if somebody comes along tomorrow and says, I've got another 100 CPUs for you, you're going to bring out a program.
Yeah. Well,
is that true?
No, because you can treat CPUs as these compute devices as well.
Right.
So in the software that Simon's been writing recently, which is this system for drug docking, the one thing it does at the beginning is that it queries all of the system and sees what devices are available. And actually, before it runs anything, it takes a small sample piece of work, runs it on each device and gets the performance, and then distributes work based on that. So yeah, there's a whole bunch of stuff in the APIs that you can query devices, see what's available. And so it's quite ad hoc, really.
Go back to an earlier chart, which showed the build process was about it.
Yeah.
So some of that you can actually
influence
at runtime. Yeah,
you can influence what you're dispatching to where, and yeah, I mean, because basically what this is doing is just creating and launching kernels onto the GPU and then reading the data back for which you perform computations on. Yeah, and so the other big issue is that it's, you know, it's a kind of restricted programming model, and for task parallelism you'd need to combine it with something like OpenMP to do threads if you wanted to express things which couldn't be expressed in a data parallel way. So one of the recent announcements by AMD is this thing called Heterogeneous System Architecture, or HSA. And the idea behind it is it's designed to support this integration of CPUs and GPUs. And AMD have designed or building this thing called an APU, which is Accelerated Processing Unit. So CPU and GPU on the same chip. This is an open architecture specification designed to capture this and to, you know, standardize things in the industry. It's being adopted by ARM, so this stuff is going to be rolled out. The specification details a virtual instruction set architecture, memory model, and dispatch, amongst other things. And the time frame they're looking to implement this is the next sort of 3 years, I think. And in terms of OpenCL, the idea is to provide an optimized platform architecture. But I think that by the looks of it, they're very keen to support other technologies such as C++ AMP and C++ .NET, Java, and things as well. Yeah, some of the features of this, like I said, integration of CPU, GPU on the same piece of silicon. It also now unifies the address spaces, and on the roadmap is potentially even GPU context switching, which seems kind of crazy, but I guess this is all in an effort to simplify the programming of these devices and to make it easier. And certainly with a shared address space between these, I don't know how that's going to impact, you know, the way in which you deal with these transfers between the two devices, and be interesting to see what the performance of this is. Yeah, so I mentioned that these two shortcomings of OpenCL, one of them being this compositionality thing, and in fact, in there's the associated C++ programming model, they're introducing PGAS-style distributed arrays to try and get around some of these problems. And also they're promoting barriers to be first-class objects in the language, so you can pass them as arguments and call methods on them. So it kind of complicates their use, but circumvents some of these issues with composing them together. I mean, it's not at all a kind of an elegant solution. But so yeah, I think the point of HSA, and obviously there's performance benefits to be had between integrating these things very tightly, you know, rather than things going off chip. But it seems like the big emphasis in this is to try and simplify the programming, and certainly it's at the expense of performance. Yeah, and I guess one of the more interesting things about it is this intermediate layer. So the way that I see it is it's a kind of similar to the LLVM intermediate representation, and it will make a good target for compilers. So it's got features for explicit parallelism, exceptions, virtual functions, system call methods, printing, I/O and stuff, debugging support. And then I think the intention is that it will be finalized or compiled to a specific architecture at runtime by a just-in-time compiler. Yeah, sounds good. The memory model, so this information is taken off of some slides that Ben Gaster, a guy who works at MD, working on this stuff, there's not any kind of official literature on it. He says they're working on a paper. This is basically what they said about the memory model. So it's compatible with C++11, Java.NET, and they relax consistency rules for improved parallel performance. Yeah, and so then the last thing is that it introduces this dispatch concept in kind of enabling it to support heterogeneous task queuing. And this is something that's going to so be implemented in the hardware, and it's going to comprise a work queue per core, distribution of work into the cores, and load balancing by work stealing between queues. So I think essentially it just means that instead of the programmer explicitly allocating kernels, it's just passed to some sort of resource manager, or it's just distributed automatically. But again, there's not much detail on this. So I think it does address a lot of the issues, but essentially, you still have this programming model that's split between the GPU and the CPU. You're still going to have to be writing separate kind of programs for both of them. And even though these things are physically closer together, there's still going to be this cost of transferring data between them. And I think that the system's still going to be very sensitive to the way in which this is done and the kind of size of data sets and things that you're working with. But I think the most important thing is it doesn't scale beyond a single chip. So what happens when you need more parallelism to obtain better performance? How do you put two chips together? This isn't talked about at all in the specification. So just to finish then on a few slides about some of the research that I'm doing at Bristol into scalable general purpose architectures. So there's this observation that programs look a lot like this. This is actually a task graph taken from a computer game engine. So you can see different bits of it here. So I think this section is some part of the rendering pipeline where there's quite a bit of data parallelism. And in this section here, you have the artificial intelligence engine. And the way that this has to work at the moment is that, yes, this piece can be mapped onto the GPU. This piece won't be computable on GPU and have to be on the CPU. But ideally, you want a fabric which can support the execution of all of these structures. And also, so that if this task graph is much larger than a single chip, that we can construct systems with multiple chips such that we can execute larger programs or more complex programs, certainly to scale performance. So a general purpose architecture, really the main idea behind it is to simplify the programming. And I think this is where we're seeing these developments like the heterogeneous system architecture moving. But certainly this is a kind of alternative in saying, well, actually, let's just sit in the middle. And I guess the claim of this research is that, yes, probably can't do better than either the GPU or the CPU, but we can deliver comparable performance. So performance to within small factors of what we'd expect on these kind of more special purpose devices. Yeah, so we want to make the programming as simple as possible, and the performance must be scalable. So parallelism is the only means that we have to increase performance. So it just seems crazy to me that you would build a system which doesn't scale in any way. So what might a scalable architecture look like? Well, potentially thousands of cores on a chip, millions of cores in a system, and built in a regular arrangement of tiles in chips, modules, and boards. And these are just a couple of diagrams. There's some number of modules connected by an interconnect, and each chip with some number of tiles. But really, I think the most important aspect of a system like this is the interconnect and the way in which they're connected together. So in this tile, we have a switch which connects processors and memories, and these black lines are the links between them. And one of the big research questions is, how can we design general purpose parallel systems, and what must the interconnect provide to be able to execute efficiently complicated parallel structures like the one I showed? So in particular, the interconnect must provide low latency, high throughput communication, and this property must scale well with the number of processors. So as you double the number of processors, you might need to triple the interconnection capacity to maintain low latency, high throughput. And it's kind of there being the conventional wisdom that you can't build networks like this. And a huge amount of the research has been based on low dimensional networks such as meshes that are fairly easy to build and to fabricate. But I think there's a lot of potential in new technology emerging, such as 3D stacking, silicon substrates for bonding chips together, and optical interconnections that will enable us to build networks that scale in this way and can support these systems. And yeah, so particular networks, some of the stuff I've been looking at are these CLOS and Hypercube. So, you know, in a mesh, if you double the size of the mesh, you double the diameter of the network, so you potentially double the latency of communication. Whereas in a CLOS and Hypercube, the diameter of the network is logarithmic in the number of nodes. So it increases much more slowly than the size of the network. And there's quite a bit of theory in the area of why this property is very attractive for general purpose systems. Yeah, so to summarise, there's a renaissance of parallel programming languages. It's really an open playing field, and it seems there's so many different ideas. It doesn't seem like anyone's got it particularly right. It's not the niche high end anymore. But also there's a lot of wheel reinventing. I mean, a lot of this stuff was known in the 1980s. It sounds like with the functional programming stuff next week. Loads of people discovering this often. One of the interesting things which I found out was a lot of talk about the Google MapReduce stuff. And this is a big excitement in parallel computing. It's the way that Google run their big infrastructure and stuff. But I think a lot of this that was developed by the functional programming community, and in particular there was work at the University of East Anglia in Chelmsford. There's a group there. And no one really remembers these innovations, but yeah, there's a huge amount more stuff going on. Yeah, this GPU thing is really interesting. It's being integrated into high-performance systems, into embedded systems, but there's still, like I said, the top supercomputer doesn't use any, so it's not clear that is the best way to be going forward. Yeah, OpenCL is gaining ground, and there is movement towards these more general-purpose systems, general-purpose models of parallelism, with the sole aim of trying to simplify the programming problem. If there's any questions?
Right, thank you very much. When you were talking about the last bit about the need for new interconnect architectures, presumably you actually are going to need new system software that can run those interconnect architectures. So we're needing, it's not just a hardware development, we need communications operating system style software that would actually manage those networks.
I don't know if you would need to manage the networks. I think that the principal thing that you would obtain when putting some of these more richly connected structures is the ability to perform much more efficient communication in the system, and in particular to enable more scalable architectures.
Right. So at the moment, if you want to talk from one board to another, you would likely find yourself using Ethernet.
Okay. So this is something that I didn't mention. And This research is based on essentially the transputer architecture and the new XMOS architecture, and the way in which that differs kind of radically from the kind of chips you see in conventional systems is that communication is a real primitive of the hardware, and in particular communications don't go into memory, and the communications link really do connect processor core to processor core. So this fabric of switches and links is the same on chip as it is off chip. So it provides a very kind of uniform means of communicating in the system. So yeah, you wouldn't have to go onto Ethernet, and there is no software. In the XMOS processors, it's in the instruction set.
More questions?
I sort of got the idea that parallel programming languages basically are an issue because we're still thinking procedurally, and in fact the situation we have isn't necessarily procedural. Obviously we've got dependencies. I think I spend more time now doing things with Excel spreadsheets than any other programming language. In Excel spreadsheets you've got effectively a distributed program, like it or not, and underneath that there is obviously some kind of engine that drives it, and we don't know whether it's parallel or serial, and we don't care because we're thinking about the thing in terms of relationships between cells in our worksheet or between worksheets or whatever. We're just thinking in a different kind of way. And it seems to me that if we didn't think procedurally, parallel programming languages would be in some way a sort of sine qua non. They would be natural to the way in which programs work. Would you like to comment on that?
Yeah, well, most of these developments are based on additions or modifications to a C-like language. And yeah, there have been more radical proposals. I mean, Occam was a good example that fell flat on its face because people weren't, well, for a number of reasons, but one of them is, you know, people are set in thinking of this, about things in this way. And then also there's a huge body of software written in this way. So I guess unless you can demonstrate very wide applicability, very simple way of being able to express things, and also, you know, a language which can deliver high performance. And certainly the various developments that have gone on with functional programming haven't kind of demonstrated that. I mean, maybe you can be able to express things simply, but it's more difficult to get a functional language to execute efficiently.
I mean, you would probably say, wouldn't you, that what David is referring to with the spreadsheet is something that is declaratively defined?
Yeah.
And what you're essentially saying is we don't know how to do all problems that way.
I'm not sure. I mean, I think that it comes down to how you implement that. And I can only relate to the functional stuff which I've read about. That has never caught on because it can't deliver the performance.
Right. Okay, I'm going to take one more question.
It was only the idea that if you have this declarative thing, what you're actually wanting is a large number of parallel processes with not that much sequential elements to them, whereas what we have here in your system is really what are essentially sequential processes, but a certain number of them, but nothing like as many processes as there are steps in each process. Am I getting the right idea in that?
In the system that I've been with.
Your systems.
Yeah.
You have a much larger number of steps in each process. So, much larger number of sequential steps in each process than you have numbers of processes.
Right.
Because when you're dealing with declarative stuff, you really want to be able to get a comparative number. Same number of processes as you have steps.
Right. So, yeah, I'm not familiar with the declarative model, but I think that this kind of system will support efficiently large numbers of processes. So large numbers of threads per core, and as I've described, large numbers of cores in the system. So, yeah, I mean, potentially there's a good match there. And like I said, there has been, I think, a lot of work done on this. I think that in these more declarative models, though, it's there are difficulties in expressing particular structures, you know, such as, you know, on there, but you know, pipelines or meshes, where you know a lot of computations precede a bunch of kind of cells, and then each cell will update based on the status of its neighbours. And defining those things in a declarative way is actually quite difficult. And so, although they make some problems a lot more simple to express, a lot of people are still vying for that kind of approach, and it remains to be seen.
I think it's time to say thank you to Jamie. What I didn't tell you at the beginning, but I think I can tell you now, is that on the organisation diagram of the department, you are a research student, and I think you did extremely well for someone with that level of experience. So let's give a big thank you to Jamie, and we really appreciate your talk.